Hey, this is Chad Webb with CrowdSouth. In today's episode of The Uncommonwealth, we talk with Mike Siemens. Mike is the former president of the Good Sam Club. Jason Heflin and Chuck Gregory are also on today's episode. The three of us worked with Mike for about 10 to 20 years through Camping World, or Affinity Group, and the Good Sam Club. Mike talks about retirement, how the Good Sam Club grew during his time there, and how he started in the mailroom and worked his way up to president. It's a great episode, and we get to talk with a good friend of ours, and Mike. The Uncommonwealth podcast comes out every other week. We hope you're enjoying the episodes and that you will subscribe to the podcast being your favorite podcast service. Let's go ahead and jump into today's episode. Thanks. Today we have Mike Siemens, who is currently retired and enjoying the good life.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Got Chuck here with us as well, and Jason too. So we all know Mike from his days with Camping World, Good Sam Club, which we all came from. But Mike, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay. Yeah, that was one of the questions that Chad told me he was going to say, introduce yourself. So, you know, I was trying to think about that. But basically, I retired about 2 years ago, spent 32 years at Camping World, Good Sam, and currently husband, father of two children, had my first grandchild, a little girl, another one on the way. Grandchild.
Congrats.
So, yeah.
not a third kid?
No. Yeah, today, I guess I would say I bought an RV since that time. So, I'm an RVer. I've entered that category. Do some property invest or real estate investing, property management, and a little bit of consulting. And basically, then just being like a grumpy old man, you know, complaining about driving, the weather, and all that stuff.
Man, minus the retirement part, that describes me.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Louisville, and specifically a little town called Shively. And Shively is kind of a hardworking blue-collar area. Lived in a little neighborhood with about 30 houses, and everybody in the neighborhood knew each other. Kids that would run around everywhere. The kind of neighborhood that if any mother in the neighborhood was allowed to spank any of the kids in the neighborhood. It was that kind of cool little fun place to grow up.
Do you still hang out with any of those people? Do you still have connections?
A number of those people were cousins, so we see a lot of those people. But then the rest of the group of the neighborhood, it's kind of a mysterious, you know, they've all kind of moved away and haven't really kept as close touch with most of them, but.
Is that code for they're in prison?
I can't answer that question.
Where'd you go to high school in Louisville?
I went to high school at Bishop David, which was an all-male Catholic school. We had a sister school that was a girls' school, too. So kind of interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of those Catholic schools up there. Is Bishop David still around?
Bishop David is now called Holy Cross.
Holy Cross, okay.
And but I went to Catholic grade school, middle school, high school, and all that. So very Louisville, and especially that area, is a very Catholic-centered area of town and a lot of Catholic schools. A lot of beer drinking, as Catholics do.
Right.
From high school, did you go on to college?
Yes. Went to school at Western Kentucky University. Best 7 years or so of my life. and then after I graduated from Western, I did attend a program through the DMA called the Direct Marketing Institute, which was about direct mail and direct marketing. So that kind of piqued my interest in that's kind of in the direct mail area.
So when you graduated, what was your degree at Western in?
My degree was in marketing and economics.
Did you jump right into Camping World or Good Sam right after Western?
Yeah. You know, my family was, the family business from Louisville was bars and liquor stores. So my formal education was in the entertainment business, I guess. And so I did that for quite a while and then bounced back and forth from school to family business, but eventually took a job at Camping World. Or I guess it was a part-time job and a temporary type thing, and started working there, and then basically never left for the next 32 years.
When was that? What year, roughly?
Oh, it was the mid-80s, 84, 85.
How big was the company then?
Wow.
How many people?
Well, the marketing department, just to kind of give you an idea, I think there were four people in the marketing department, excluding Murray Coker, who was a senior-level guy, but We operated out of a little farmhouse on Beach Bend Road down at the amusement park there. And so basically that was it. That was the department, four people.
How many are in the marketing department now?
Gosh.
Roughly.
If I had to guess today, all the locations, over 100 for sure.
Wow.
So
did you spend a lot of time, like I said, you'd mentioned out there on Beach Bend Road. Did you work directly with Garvin at all?
Mr. Garvin was around a lot at that time. Donnelly was starting to take over the reins of the company. And I think at that time, Tad was maybe 28 years old. So everybody in the entire company was very young. David Garvin was maybe only, you know, in his mid-40s. But he, shortly after that, kind of turned the reins over to the young people in the company, and they took off with it. So it was kind of an interesting time. But David was around, and a lot of his principles and things that he believed in and how the company should be run were almost kind of woven into the fabric of the company and the culture. So it's almost like he was there.
A little background, too. Everyone at this table worked at Camping World or Good Sam at some point in their career.
Yep.
And also owned Jeeps at some point in their career.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Two Mike, the same Jeep. Retired guy, still does.
Yeah.
Yep. Did so, because we keep saying this, like you said, Camping World, Good Sam, we actually worked at Affinity Group, the three of us. Were you always Camping World? Or, I mean, I know you're Good Sam there at the end. Did your job ever switch between those companies?
It went back and forth. And I worked on certain projects or programs or businesses that were on the Good Sam side of the house or the Affinity Group side of the house, if you will, and then also the Camping World side. I think at one time they even split my salary. Half of them paid this and half paid the Camping World portion of the salary. So got a lot of exposure to different people and products, locations.
Sure.
It's pretty cool.
That first job you had, you said mid-80s. How old were you when you took that job? Do you remember?
I think I was in my early 20s at that point.
So I'd
have to do the math, and right. I'm not doing math today. So
Right.
But
that's that economics minor at work.
Yeah, I'm done with that. But, you know, the first job that I had there, interestingly enough, was in the mailroom. You know, I came in and went to the post office, picked up catalogs and flyers and stuff that were return mail to the post office, brought them back to the company and had to sort through them and process them. So I always like to tell my kids that literally I started in the mailroom, you know, I started at ground zero. And, but then shortly after that, then other opportunities came around, different projects and sort of like, anything that anybody didn't want to do, that was my job for about the first 3 years.
Yep.
So there is a career in doing stuff that no one wants to do, by the way.
Well, now, when I was there, the mailroom was like the source of all the gossip. If you wanted to know like something that was about 40% inaccurate but fun, that's where you'd go. Was that the case back then?
Yes. I think every building that I've ever been in that has a little mailroom area is like that. A little side note, and hopefully I won't get anybody in trouble, but the mailroom that was in our office down at Beach Bend Park, on Fridays we used to bring beer in, you know, bring a six-pack or so, you know, and bag of pretzels. And that was our little 3 o'clock on thing. You know, we had to watch for cars coming down the lane in case Murray Coke or Tad or one of the guys were coming in. But we would sit around and kind of talk about the business, drink a few beers, and then head to the house. So.
And it wasn't even necessarily that you were worried that you'd get in trouble. You're like, they didn't pay for this. They're gonna take our beer.
Yeah, there were only two beers per right. per drinker.
Yeah.
You only had so many to go around.
So that was when the main office was at the store, right? And it's like that one side or upstairs of the store.
Right. The main office, so to speak, was the retail store and the warehouse combination, and then the marketing department was an old farmhouse. Mm-hmm. So it was ideal, actually. You know, it was a lot of independence, and if there were a meeting, then you just jump in the car and, you know, drive a couple of miles up the road to the office. But
was that the farmhouse that had the fire pole, like from the second floor down?
I wasn't sure if there was a pole in that one. No. I don't remember. Oh, a fire pole.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't remember a fire pole, but
okay,
that may have been a different house. Yeah. I don't know what house you were at, Chuck.
Yeah. I think it's one Dave got married at. I know he got they've got to borrow that.
Oh,
it was really
cool.
Nice. They may have, you know, renovated it and put stuff like that in, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. No fire pole at this house, but I want to check out that house that you went to. I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been mentioned that we need a fire pole here in the office.
Okay.
Yeah, so we can get to go from the first or second to the first floor.
Yeah.
It'd be tough to go first to second on it. Take a lot of work.
It's part of the interview process.
Yeah. So what were the, if you're comfortable talking about it, what were the, that path over the 30 years at Camping World, what did that look like? How much time was basically at each of your stops along the rungs, and then kind of, and I think, I hope younger people listen to this as well and understand that there is, like you had said, starting at the mail room, there's time that you put in to get to where you want to be. Just like when I joined Camping World, I started off at the, in the call center, and then I looked diligently for a year, 6 months, trying to find the position that I took when Chuck was my boss, which was an intern position in the web department. So there are times where, like I said, you have to put in some work, but then you grow. And so maybe talk through that process.
Because I think the great thing about this story is you did go from the mailroom to president over the course of that term. So there were a few stops along the way.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that I never really felt like there was these big jumps. It just kind of was a natural evolution. And Camping World was and Good Sam as well, very entrepreneurial company. And they allowed people, young and somewhat inexperienced people, to try things and to do things. And I mean, I can look around at you guys and know that you benefited from that as well, you know, starting a web within the company and working in some of those areas. But with Camping World, I basically came in and started taking responsibility for, you know, maybe a small project, and sometimes that turned into something bigger. But you really do have to get your foot in the door and prove yourself with one job or maybe a second job, and then things sometimes start to happen. And that's the way it was at Camping World. And until 32 years later, I said, you know, I think that's enough. You know, I just was ready to go on and do other things, and felt like the timing was good for me and for the company to leave. And so that's what I did. But the sort of reward was that if you do a pretty good job and you don't screw stuff up, you know, they'll give you another responsibility or another area or another. And fortunately, with that company having multiple hats, 2 and 3 and 4 different things, you weren't just a one trick pony. You know, you if something didn't really pan out, you didn't necessarily lose your job. You might have gotten rid of one of your hats, and then you might get two more. So that's a great thing that I think was at place in both of those companies that many of us benefited from.
Was you did a lot of unconscious, I think you're referencing some of the things, some unconscious things you did that advanced you through the company, you know, but were there any conscious things you did through your career to try to, did you position yourself a certain way, or did you try to be a certain way in your business dealings that you feel like advanced you or made you stand out?
You know,
because not everybody became president. So,
no.
So you did something differently.
No. I don't know that I really did anything consciously. I feel like that I tried to be a good human. You know, I wasn't, or at least, you know, hopefully nobody's going to come and post comments on the site after this. But I tried to treat everyone fairly and be ethical. And other than that, just, you know, hard work. I mean, a lot of times great opportunities and luck is on that road of hard work. And if you're working hard, then things have a tendency to happen. So I think that's one of the things that helped me. The other thing was I didn't take opportunities that I didn't have a lot of interest in or didn't feel like that was something I wanted to do. You know, and I had a few of those opportunities where I thought, man, this could be a good jump, but I absolutely don't want to work in this department. They didn't ask me to work in IT, but just think of some other things, you know. Right. And I will say this, Chad, you mentioned it about the call center, that you look around at a lot of the key players in that company, Tamara Ward, the COO, or other vice presidents, or these are people who started working in an internship or a call center environment where you come in and, you know, you're absolutely not on the fast track anywhere, but you got your foot in the door, and those people rose up and became successful. So it's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a particular role that you enjoyed the most? So compensation and control aside, was there a stop along the career path where you said, you look back and say, that one was fun?
I enjoyed creating new businesses and new programs and new services. And the company allowed that to take place. It was a very bootstrap kind of organization that, you know, you kind of had to make do with the resources that were there. You know, you may not be able to go out and spend $500,000 on this piece of equipment or a database or whatever, but if you could make it work, then you were in tall cotton. If you could get in there, use the resources and make the business work. So you just had to work with limited resources a lot of time in less than ideal situations. And I kind of enjoyed that challenge, you know, looking back at a lot of those things that we did, because if we hadn't done it that way, many of those would have never gotten off the ground. When we started the club program, which was started back in the mid-80s, I look back now and think, man, it was pretty cutting edge for that time. People didn't have loyalty programs. They didn't have membership clubs. But, you know, we started one and we had many of the key attributes that a lot of the clubs and memberships have today. They had a loyalty component, you know, where you earn points. They had a discount component where you received discounts based on being a member. They had a database. But now the database was a big card file that looked like the library, where you would put 3x5 index cards. You put write somebody's name on the index card or put a mailing label on it. And then you'd put the card, you'd file it in the card file. And that was the database. There was no technology. There was no computer that managed that. When someone renewed their membership, they called in. You crossed out the old date. You wrote the new date in. You put it back in the card file.
Do you remember the day that they made a switch? Because at some point, and you were there, they made a switch from those cards to an electronic version of that, right?
Right.
Were people scared to death of going to that and losing the cards?
It was a storm.
Yeah.
You know, like any technology integration, you know, there were a lot of things that went wrong in that. But eventually, we got our arms around it, and it just was necessary. I can't recall the file at that time, but it was probably 35,000 members that were being managed on a 3x5 index card system.
So real quick, one thing I guess we should say, because we're taking it all as knowledge that we already have, but could you explain what Good Sam Club is real quick, and right. As well as Camping World?
Well, President's Club too, which I think that's the club we started, and then how those came together.
Camping World, coincidentally, the Good Sam Club and kind of its sister club, the President's Club, were started at the exact same time. You know, they were, I don't want to say born, but the concept was initiated and separately, independently. And at some point down the road, Camping World was acquired by Affinity Group, which owned the Good Sam Club. So now this company owned two clubs. One was President's Club. It was more of a buyer's club for products and services at Camping World. And then there was the Good Sam Club, which was more of a lifestyle and services membership organization that promoted not only just those products that help make your RV lifestyle more enjoyable and safer, but also was a bit of a social club as well. So as time went on, the company really started to look at both these clubs and said, you know, wouldn't it be more efficient? Wouldn't members be better off? A lot of these people are in the same club. Wouldn't it be better if we just brought them together and made them one club? And they chose Good Sam Club as the name for that. And so President's Club was kind of molded into Good Sam, one club with more benefits.
That was in the early 2000s?
97.
Was it 97?
97. Well, 97 was when the companies.
The club merger was like 2012.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or 11.
97 is when I started with the company.
Okay.
And coincidentally, I started in the President's Club as an intern. I interviewed with you.
And now
you remember that vividly, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Everything about it. God, this guy really wowed me. This 21-year-old kid.
Nobody ever lasted a long time in there.
Smelled like a hangover. Hired him straight away. No, there was a layer between us. Lori and
Paul.
Paul
Forrester.
Yeah, I reported to them. So Anyway, thanks, Mike. Thanks for my first job.
You have to start somewhere.
Biggest mistake. That's on this list. What's your biggest
mistake? Yeah, what's your biggest mistake? That's a good transition.
Say hiring Jason.
I will say, Mike, I was there 26 years, and you were always kind of that, when times were bad or whatever, that voice of sanity. It was always someone you go talk to and just, you know, always feel good about it. So, I was always glad you were there.
Well, thank you. Sometimes it helped me to talk about my problems. Yeah. Right.
It was less fun when you weren't there.
And while we're patting Mike's back, I'll say that there was a period there where Mike and I decided to start jogging at lunch. And this was down the road after I wasn't a measly intern. And so we would go over to Tennis Town. We paid those guys to use their showers, which was an indoor tennis facility. And we would go jogging at lunch. And I swear, man, I bet you, I don't know how you kept doing it, because I know all I did was complain the entire, this is going on at work and this. And again, like, he was the voice of like, well, man, just, you know, just roll with it and do this. And he'd always give me a little advice, but not too much, just enough to kind of basically just say, shut up. What are you complaining about? Come on, man. And you're slow. Keep up. But yeah, thanks. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, I think I was probably in better mental and physical shape at that time in my life, but, you know.
Those first, what we would do it, we wouldn't do it in the coldest months, but, you know, March would roll around and we'd start doing it again, and that was always the hardest. But we would encourage each other to get out there and drop our winter 10 pounds or whatever it was.
I know you got a lot of notes there. What's some stuff that you wanted to raise or talk about?
Well, really, you know, I appreciate you sending over some questions, because it kind of made me reflect back on all the stuff that had gone on through the years. And many of these things I've never really sat down and given it consideration. But, you know, looking back at this organization, looking back at Camping World and looking back at Good Sam, it seemed like that it was a lot of different companies over the years, because it's, you know, you think about, well, you went and worked at one company for 32 years. It really didn't feel like that. It felt like that it went through a lot of evolutions, and it went from a very mom and pop, you know, small operation to, you know, with a handful of stores to this multi-billion dollar organization. And those were two dramatically different companies to work for, to everything. All the way you would operate in the early days was not really the way that it would work in when you became a $3 billion company. So, you know, I think that that's one of the things that I've enjoyed working for all those different companies. And, you know, if I had to do it over again, it'd be great to be able to say, well, you know, I'd love to go work for a mom and pop again, because I really like that. Not as much the $3 billion stressful publicly traded company. You know, that was cool to get to that point and see it. But I do enjoy a more stress-free kind of life and style. And if I do projects and work today, you know, I hope that it's around smaller companies, and, you know, where you can still have a lot of fun. And like you guys, you know, you do a lot of things that are unique for a company your size and for companies in general, but you guys have a great time. You have good people. They genuinely seem like they like to come to work every day, and you know, they're young, and it feels like the way that Camping World used to be.
Mm-hmm. I can make no promises what's going to happen when we become a $3 billion
company. It will not be a fun place to
Jason work. Will be a jerk.
I won't be here.
Well, a few people left before it got to $3 billion, and they were like Mr. Garvin. You know, he set sail quite a bit earlier than that, and I think he was fine with that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
But I was very proud of the work that we did. The people that I worked with, you know, were all good, passionate, hardworking people. And, you know, I was, you know, you work for a company that you would say you were proud of, and that was cool. That was a cool thing. And I don't know today if there are a lot of people that can say that, or that they like their job. And mm-hmm. I had good days, I had bad days, but I did have a lot more good days than bad days. Mm-hmm. So
that's good.
The name of this podcast is The Uncommon Wealth, theming on kind of Kentucky-based entrepreneurs, business owners, people who've run companies. Your situation's unique somewhat from some of the other people that we've had on the show. So, you're retired. You've decided to stay in this in Kentucky and continue doing business here. Could you tell us a little bit about, I mean, you could have gone to a warmer climate. You could have just hit the road once you retired, but you just decided to stick around.
Until Thursday of this week.
Oh, see, all right, all right.
But no, I like Kentucky, and I really like Bowling Green. It helps that my daughter's here. My son isn't here at the moment, but it's an easy town to come back to, you know, later on if somebody wants to do it. Just easy living. I love to go to Nashville. I like to go to restaurants there. I like all the fun there, but I would rather live here and go and be entertained there. Just easy on traffic, easy on a lot of things that are very high on the quality of life scale.
We've got a small office in Louisville, and I've been going up there and getting to know that town a little better. It's where you're from. Do you get back up there very much?
I do. I get up there several times a year. And downtown, too. Downtown has been completely transformed. And even though there's a lot going on downtown, and it's really cool, and if you haven't been down there, I would encourage you to check it out. But it's not as expensive and as fast-paced as, say, Nashville is today.
What's your favorite restaurant in Louisville right now?
I love Jeff Ruby's. I mean, it's a kind of traditional old steakhouse and that, but the service is outstanding, and I think they have probably the best steak, one of the best steaks in the country.
Have you ever tried Ryan's Steakhouse?
Ryan's. I don't know him.
Oh, okay. We were up there. Chad and I were up in that office this week, past week, and we went to Wagner's. Is that what it's called?
Yeah,
the one across from Churchill.
Wagner's
down?
Pharmacy.
Okay.
It was good. It was like
diner,
like kind of like Brendan's, Brendy's.
Yeah, like a dive. Yeah.
There's a lot of little small neighborhood bars and restaurants and stuff, and a lot of them have been there for forever. So I like that part of it too. It's cool, you know, and Bardstown Road is kind of a funky, unique place that offers a lot of restaurants and nightlife and little shops and stuff. So I get up there quite a bit. You know, my mother is still there, and a good bit of my family is still in Louisville. So that gets us up there on a more frequent basis.
We went to Muscle and Burger Bar when we were up this last time and had, what was it called? It was like a duck and turkey.
Grilled turkey.
Turduck sandwich. It was really good. Super greasy. Try it next time you're
there. Let's check that out.
Go to the Muscle restaurant and get the turkey and duck sandwich.
Yeah, just don't get mussels.
or a burger.
Gotta be weird.
One of my other favorite places, just to give this a plug, is called Jack Fry's. It's on Bardstown Road. Sometimes it can be hard to get into, but it's a small restaurant, but the food is off the charts and great wine list. So if you get up there, check that one out.
Thank you to our sponsor today, Jack Fry's, Bardstown Road. All right. I'm not writing a jingle for it, though.
There you go. So the Crowd South is what year are you guys celebrating this year?
It's our seventh year. And by the way, this is the point in the podcast where we start getting interviewed by the
person. It always happens.
It's our seventh year. It's our seventh year. And it'll be our seventh year in August. So things are going good. It's fun. Your son was our first intern.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah. He is. I know he's still interested in – is he still interested in music and that career path eventually?
He is.
And he's in Denver right now?
He's in Denver, right? Denver. So, yeah, I think he wants to be in marketing if at all possible. And music marketing was his marketing in New York and working for Sony Music and RCA. And so that part of the dream, you know, he was able to live. And
he probably learned a lot from that. And it probably shapes the way that he sees the future, which is I think what, you know, a lot of times when you're talking about starting off in the mailroom or starting off at the call center, you learn a lot about a company in those lower positions because you can also see what else is going on and kind of what you aspire to inside that path. And so I think I'm sure Mitch saw a lot of that because I'm sure he when he did that internship, he probably, you know, had to do a bunch of menial jobs and stuff like that. But I'm certain he also saw the positive things there.
He probably learned more than he did when he worked for that company that was a first-year startup and out of a 200-square-foot office, played Xbox about 2 hours
a day. Yeah, I was going to say, Mitch's expectations were set pretty low.
In terms of we probably ruined that, actually.
Yeah. They just all they do is go eat tacos and play Xbox.
Come on, Mitch, eat tacos. Let's go.
He got the opportunity, I know, one day to deliver lunch to Art Garfunkel. And I said, so here's the deal. Take your phone and like put it in your top pocket like that and turn it on. And then as you walk up, you know, you'll be recording him and you delivering the sandwich and all that. And I think he was too scared to try to pull that one off.
He would have got Art Garfunkel slapping the sandwich out of his hands. That's not what I ordered.
I think that, though, that brings up a good point. You know, you were asking about the advice that you give to younger people and all that that are starting out. And, and everybody has something that they probably feel is good advice. But for Mitch as well is that this is about change. And things are going to change. Even if he went in and got it landed the big job at Sony, something could come along and they could shut that division down and he'd have to change again, or they would change the roles or whatever. And I think in the companies that I've worked at, and they're not fast-paced technology companies. The RV industry moves pretty darn slow. I mean, they still have the same awning that was put on in 1966, and it's pretty much works the same way. So it's not mind-bending pace of change, but being able to adapt and change and get your mind around change too, because it's the only certain, and it will continue to come at you, and you'll have to deal with change over and over again. But if you can kind of see the change coming, be open-minded to it, and then ultimately, if that's going to happen, you have to kind of accept it and move on. The better that you get at that, I think the better you will be able to adapt and survive in an organization. And I remember Marcus Lemonis one time saying, somebody said they really didn't like change, and he was like, wow, this is going to be really tough for you.
This world?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's the change master, you know, and probably saw more change under his leadership than probably anyone else. And you kind of get used to that. You get used to the speed of it and just the how broad the change is, and you get behind it, or you usually have to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So
that's a good point. I think a lot of young people have expectations and goals, and they have a plan, but that plan always gets derailed. You never end up where you thought you were. So being open enough to adjust that plan as you move, it's got to be a learning. It's got to be a point where you learn that and start to adjust around it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's look here. What else do I have? What would you say, is there something you're most proud of during your time at Camping World, Good Sam?
Yeah.
Hiring Jason.
That was key. That was pretty key.
That's right. I got it. I got you.
It's hard to kind of pick any one thing out, but I do look back on the area that I think I had the most impact was the club and the club business and the membership. And I think it was brilliant for the company to come up with that so many years ago. And looking at how the company moved forward, I think that was absolutely critical, because they were able to capture every customer that came in the door by name, and then later on email and phone number and all the transactional data and that. And when it became very difficult to identify RVers because the Department of Motor Vehicles did not give out names and addresses of people that bought RVs, you had to go and gather up that information somewhere. So Camping World and Good Sam were in the enviable position of having had a membership where you had all that data, and it became hard for people to kind of get in, you know, it was a good barrier to entry, so to speak. And I was proud to have worked in that area and managed that and continued to grow it until the time that I left. And so,
What did you see that list grow to in your time there?
We were just short of 2 million members. And then when you start thinking about that, 2 million members, then kind of put the math to that on $25 to $30 a year in fees and stuff. So it was a huge financial contributor. And it was a very, probably one of the best, biggest assets the company had was that list. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of names and addresses outside of the membership, but the membership really was the crown jewel of their marketing program. And they could market to those people much differently than anyone else because they knew where they lived, they knew where they were traveling, they knew what they bought, they knew where they were. I mean, they just knew so much about these the folks there that I think it really aided in the growth of the company and all the other parts of the business.
Being a lifestyle brand, that you were also able to use that list for upselling ancillary services and insurances and so forth. So I know that compounded the numbers that you were already making through the membership. So
yeah. It was, and you know what? And a lot of this, it allowed them to connect with each other, you know, mm-hmm. because you had people with like interests and stuff in certain areas, then club groups were formed and tour people rallied together and went on rallies and events and tours and that. So there was a lot of social aspect of, you know, that came out of membership and club. Very, very proud of that.
You see any companies that excite you, maybe in the retail space or were similar to Camping World or even in the outdoor space that are doing things that you see similarities to what you were doing back in the day?
You know, I'm sitting here as you ask the question, trying to think of one, and no one really pops in my head.
Yeah, it wasn't a unicorn. It wasn't the only mm-hmm. company out there doing interesting things or doing unique things, but for the RV industry, it was revolutionary.
Yeah, I think Harley Davidson has done and did a great job through the years of creating a lifestyle, maybe where there wasn't really one. Mm-hmm. I mean, they brought a lot of those people together and sold a lot of product and, gosh, a ton of wearables. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, and not just trying to force product on people seeking it out and trying to find it and getting it and. If you're a Harley owner, you know, you probably have 50 different things from t-shirts mm-hmm. to jackets and hats and whatnot that have that logo on it. And that's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really worked that brand. Like I always think of Yeti, you know, I mean, everybody's wearing this apparel, stickers, whatever those things are. It's a cooler. Mm-hmm. I mean, growing up, I would not have had an Igloo or Coleman, you know.
Mm-hmm. What's crazy hat. About especially the Good Sam Club, is that they're self-forming. Like the company's not doing any, like pushing them to, hey, go form your own little groups and have your little rallies. And like, it's just naturally occurring. You know, that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. Yeah. That you're right about that. And, you know, maybe that's the best kind is ones. I mean, it's good for the company maybe to facilitate certain things, but when people come together on their own with their own agenda and, there's kind of self-managed things tend, I think, to work a little better than, you know, some jughead like myself in the middle of it trying to, you know, mm-hmm. create rules and that. And Good Sam has managed to do that for, gosh, since the mid-80s, mm-hmm. maybe even longer than that. I can't, you know, as I sit here and think about it, because they had groups and, you know, informal groups and that probably predate when they came up with the little smiling halo man, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah, I think so.
It took the brand took a life of its own and the members began owning the brand more than the brand owned itself. And that's great. When we talk to companies about rebranding, we ask them what their brand is. And sometimes people will define their brand as, you know, what they believe it to be, but it's really the best thing to do is to look at your consumer, your customer and say, what do you think it is? What is it to you? And those important things are the things you can really draw from rather than what you want it to be, because it takes a life of its own once it's out in the world, mm-hmm. just like a kid. Can't control those little things.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome, Chad. You're welcome, Chad. What's the next question?
Oh, the next question. Yes, yes. We're coming to the end here, but I don't want to miss anything that you have because you look like you took a lot of notes. What else did you have, Mike?
Well, you asked me about how was retirement.
Yeah, that was
you know, that was I had a retirement question too. Yeah, I was going to wait till we got here. Yeah.
We're all super excited about retirements. How's yours going?
Yeah, I've not been disappointed with retirement. You know, it's everything that I thought that it was going to be and then some. But to be honest, I mean, I still get up and, you know, I do stuff every day and I work and I do take on some projects. And so I feel like I'm tasked with a few things, not a lot of stuff that I absolutely have to do like this minute, or I don't have to get on conference calls very often. I try to avoid conference calls these days. But I will say this, it's the flexibility of being able to kind of work and do things when you want to do it and not when you don't want to. It I think is the best part about what I would call retirement. It's just flexibility and lack of just stress. Mm-hmm. You know, there is stress in work, and I don't care what job you have, but some are worse than others. But I do find that my stress level these days is quite a bit lower than it used to be, and I really enjoy that. So I highly recommend retirement, and if you have the means.
Are the early bird specials as great as I hear?
They are. You know, you get wired into that stuff. You know, I know what's going on a Monday night now. You know, yeah. Where to get the best deals. But you know what? I do think the thing about retirement is it also allows you to do things that maybe you couldn't do before, you know, or maybe didn't do before. I never took longer vacations, you know, and when you go and take 6 weeks and go somewhere, you really get to see an area. You really get to experience what that area is about and all the things to see and do. And when you leave there, you really feel like that you've checked it out versus you kind of rush to get there. And then you get there and you spend a week. And then mm-hmm. the next thing you know, you're in the car headed home thinking, man, it took me 3 days to unwind,
right?
And I enjoyed 4 days. So
a lot of it is you're back to work on, like, you're, you know how it is, like with, I mean, everyone knows how it is. Everyone usually takes week vacations, but you get down there, the first couple of days are exciting. Then you've got the middle day, and then it's like, oh gosh, I got to go back to, you know, I got to start taking that drive back from Florida in 2 days. And then on the drive back, you know, if it's Saturday or Sunday, you're thinking about Monday going into work. So, I mean, that's a good point. It would be nice to spend the amount of time where you feel like you've embedded yourself in a, even if it's in the United States, an area of the country that really it's like, okay, well now I know where the grocery is, or I know where the sports bar is that I like to go to, things like that. Do you think that with retirement, do you think it's important to, because some people are fine with just like sitting on the couch and watching TV or just piddling around, not doing much. It seems like that's a quick way to get like your mind just kind of wandering and mm-hmm. just really not. I mean, are you finding that? Have you had any days where you're just like, I got to get up and do something, or I mean, I can't do this. I can't sit on this couch for the next 6 hours.
Yeah. I don't find myself drawn to the couch for 6 hours. I usually have stuff that I want to do, but I could see where that could happen if someone, maybe if they didn't have a routine or something that would get them up and get them out. And so far, I haven't had that. If I do start hitting the couch for that long a period, I'm going to call you guys to come get me.
Well, we had to have some puzzles we were going to get.
Yeah, surely there's something better that I could do with my time. But the good news is, if you want to do 6 hours on the couch, you've got that at least on from time to time.
I think there's times though where I think about, like, sometimes worry about retirement in terms of, I know that I'm no good on my own. Like, I know that, like, me left to my own devices is just a recipe for laziness and being slothful and all that stuff.
It's just so you want to have like a something to do, like a reason to get up and go out there.
Well, I think there's feel that. Needed, I think know? There's yeah, feel needed. I think there's that around a purpose still, which yeah. I think is maybe where you find yourself still being open to do things like this or open to consult as needed and stuff like that.
I think there were a few things that I kind of put in place before I left. You know, before I, you know, went out to the door at Camping World. And so they were, I don't want to say trial balloons, but, you know, I started buying investment property and started doing a little bit of work there. And when you have a demanding full-time job, it's hard to spend a lot of time outside of work and your social with your family and whatnot. So I had those things in place and had started to kind of grow the number of properties that I picked up. And I knew that was going to be like a, I don't want to call it a pastime, but it was an investment, and it was a form of, I enjoy doing some of that work, you know, and renovation and cleanup and all that. So put that in place knowing that, well, that's something that I can do. And then you can always hire that stuff out if you mm-hmm. get tired of it, or you simply don't want to do it. You know, at least it's an investment. It's not a motorcycle.
Sure.
And say, well, I'm going to sell it, you know, and get rid of it. This would at least hopefully be an appreciating asset and something that also requires a little bit of time. So
I think I would hire out all my investment work to you. Mike wants to go change a toilet. I'll let him do that.
Yeah, I think if I could do it over again, I think I would have become a plumber. You know, my grandfather was a plumber, and now I look at, I think that might be my next gig. I sure use a lot of plumbers in that in the rental business. That's probably the number one.
Sure.
Plumbing.
Are they just flushing? Like I've had two calls on the little small apartment that I had that they flushed Barbies down the toilet.
I've had a few little
knickknacks,
things that have happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
Things that have been that went down that weren't supposed to go down.
Right.
Yeah.
I just think it's weird because I was like, I get that it's a rental, but I'm like, why do I have to pay that you shoved a Barbie down there? What did you think was going to happen?
Yeah.
Like, but I guess that's what you do with rental.
Well, in the RV business, you have gray water and then you have brown water.
Yeah.
Or black water. Mm-hmm. You know, I think black water is the technical term, but I don't do black water.
No.
I do on the RV, but in
the rental. I'll unplug your sink, but your toilet.
If there's a problem there, I get the professionals in right away. They have the tools and they've got the. It's one of those things that I don't want to do a lot of experimenting with. So,
note to self. Mike, this is since you're from Kentucky and this is sort of about people from Kentucky, what's your favorite bourbon?
Yes.
All of it. What's your least favorite?
Yeah.
Now, you come from a family who owned liquor stores, so you probably have a familiarity with the good and the bad.
I do really like a lot of bourbons, and probably my kind of go-to is Maker's Mark, just like everyday sipping kind of bourbon. But I'll have 10 or 15 different bourbons at the house all the time of stuff that I try and that other people like. I know they like and they come over. You know, you got to kind of have their bourbon too. And so typically when I'm drinking with buddies or whatnot, I'll drink different bourbons, mm-hmm. you know, just to have that variety of taste and that. A little known fact, the neighborhood that I talked about in the beginning where the you know all the kids ran and played, it was near 7th Street Road in Louisville, which is where a lot of the distilleries had their barrel houses and that. And so mm-hmm. when we walked down the railroad tracks from the neighborhood, the barrel houses were there, and we used to throw rocks at the side of the metal buildings and, you know, till the guys would come out and chase us away. But that one of the barrel houses that there was is it Stetzer Weller? The mm-hmm. people that have Pappy Van Winkle. Yeah. So mm-hmm. that bourbon, one of the premier bourbons in the country, it all goes back to my early mm-hmm. years, my elementary school years. And it was probably a lot closer to my house than I even realized at that time. But
did you actually ever break a window out?
I don't think we broke any windows.
You've admitted to two crimes so far in this podcast.
Since Mike said he keeps bourbons at his house for his friends, we really should tell him our favorites instead.
So. Right. This podcast does travel, so we may record the next one in your den.
I'll keep it in your locker over there.
Yeah. Right. Thanks, man.
Well, Mike, thank you for your time. I think we'll finish. We appreciate you coming in and letting us hear about all the stuff an old-timer gets to tell us.
Oh, hey, I will be here anytime. I enjoy coming out, and congratulations on 7 years. It doesn't seem like it's been that long, but you guys are on your way.
Thank you.
Proud of you.
Appreciate it, man.
Thanks,
thank
Mike.
You.
Yeah, appreciate your all that you've all your advice and mentorship through the years.
Yep.
All right.
Cool,
guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks.